This is On Shifting Ground. I'm Ray Suarez. In the backdrop of these latest U.S.-China political disputes was the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation event held in Palm Springs. The United States was host to the meeting, which involved more than 1,500 delegates from 21 economies hashing out trade issues and agreements. There was no shortage of tears and splits within the organization, as each economy grapples with the vast economic effects of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the aftershocks of U.S.-China trade war. Just before the calls for a TikTok ban in Washington, Matt Murray, State Department senior official overseeing APEC, joined me to talk about how he was faring with his counterparts and what the U.S., as the host, had prioritized this year. Welcome to On Shifting Ground.
Thanks, Ray. It's great to be here.
What issues have dominated the APEC gathering this year?
APEC, at its core, is really focused on promoting trade and investment around the region. But in recent years, and particularly coming out of the COVID pandemic, it's really shifted a lot of the focus in APEC to sustainability and to resilience and making sure that we're putting economic growth on an equal footing across the region. Also shifting towards economic inclusion and the need to make sure that all members of society are able to fully participate in economies around the Asia-Pacific region. And as such, the theme of our APEC 2023 host year is creating a resilient and sustainable future for all.
For the last year, the United States has been trying to isolate Russia economically. Was Russia invited to the gathering on American soil?
So Russian officials were here in Palm Springs. They also participated virtually only for a meeting that we held in Hawaii in December. We have said across APEC, we want to be good stewards of this opportunity to host this year. This is only our third time hosting, so it's a really special opportunity. Obviously, we have significant concerns with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Certainly, that is a strong focus from the president, the secretary, and everyone across our administration to make sure that we are doing everything we can to really push back on Putin's war there in Ukraine. And so one of the things in APEC is the focus on the economic aspect. And we have been very clear that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is not just a humanitarian disaster and an unneeded war of aggression, but it's also having significant economic impacts around the region. And so many of our partners around the Asia Pacific have focused on the challenges of food security, the challenges of energy security, the challenges of rising prices, all of which have been exacerbated by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So we've made very clear to our Russian counterparts that while they are here at the APEC meetings, we do not consider it to be business as usual in dealing with Russia. We've also made clear to our partners throughout APEC that we need to really push for Russia to take a responsible approach and for all of us to raise the concerns we have about not only the humanitarian situation and the war, but just the economic impacts of it.
Well, APEC is first and foremost an economic body, and it very studiously doesn't get involved in security and political concerns. But when you have senior officials from a lot of different governments in one place, are there opportunities for sidebars? Did senior Chinese and American leaders take the opportunity to huddle in bilateral meetings during the conference? And if so, what was on the agenda?
Absolutely. I met with my Chinese counterpart, senior official counterpart here in Palm Springs. I also have met with her recently at the meetings that we held in Honolulu in December and the meeting in Bangkok in November. We want to have a regular dialogue with our Chinese counterparts about what we can do together in APEC. But I think it's also very important that one of the reasons to really be actively engaged and to be a leader in an organization like APEC is to make sure that we're also here to stand up for U.S. values, to stand up for international rules and norms, and to stand up for important multilateral institutions like APEC. So I also have made very clear to my Chinese counterparts when I believe that China is acting in a manner in which we feel like they're undermining international rules and norms or where they're undermining APEC as an institution. And so we'll have that kind of discussion as well. But it's really important that when we are part of an organization like APEC, and especially when we're hosting, it's a really amazing platform to have these kinds of discussions at all levels. I think a lot of times people are concerned that diplomats aren't getting enough opportunities to engage, to talk about difficult issues, to talk about differences of opinion. But every time we get together in the APEC context, not only do we have an agenda that we're trying to work through on the regional economic cooperation side, but it's also a terrific platform at the senior officials level, later in the year at the minister's level, and ultimately in November at the leader's level, to have a lot of really high-level discussions bilaterally as well in order to advance economic prosperity, but also to advance diplomacy in our region.
Only slightly tongue-in-cheek, some people call China and the United States the G2. They are two very important countries, and it's been a tumultuous year in the relationship, with tensions over tacit support for the Russian invasion of Ukraine, over the recent spy balloon flyovers, over President Biden's security guarantees to Taiwan, the Biden administration's commitment to moving chip production onshore and blocking sale of the most advanced microprocessors to China, even banning TikTok on government telephones. Well, now that I'm saying it out loud, it seems like a pretty long list. How would you describe the relationship in 2023?
Well, I can really answer that from the perspective of APEC. And again, I think it's a tremendous opportunity in an organization like APEC to be able to address some of these issues in a multilateral way, where China is one of the members and China is a very important member. And obviously, you know, they're a huge economy that has an outsized influence on the region. But I don't look at my engagements in APEC as being engaging with one other economy. I look very much at my engagements with APEC being with all of the economies. And, you know, we have to be able to communicate clearly. I think that the president, the secretary have talked about the importance of communication with China and the importance of communication with other partners. And that's the way that we're going to be able to push back on any concerns that we have of things China's doing, but also ways in which we might be able to find areas where we could cooperate. And so we also talk about how APEC, the C stands for cooperation. So we want to try to promote as much cooperation as we can with all the members here so that we really can address some of the serious challenges that we're facing as a region. We're coming out of the COVID pandemic. Economies still haven't fully recovered from that economically. We've got a climate crisis. We have across the region insufficient participation in the economy by women and by underrepresented groups. There's a lot of things that we need to work on together. And so I think that China is part of that equation and part of that discussion. And certainly when there are bilateral issues between the United States and China, it makes things a little bit more complicated. But my role and my goal every time that we come out for one of these meetings is to see what we can make happen as we move forward with all of the economies that are members of APEC.
Can you really bar the doors and keep security out of it? I mean, North Korean missiles are flying around and China's pushing out its sea border using rocky outcroppings in the South China Sea and saying that's its new border. Members of the Anglosphere are very much part of a security posture that is keeping a close eye on China and Russia. Is it a challenge to sort of go on and just keep the conversations about economics?
Sure, it's absolutely a challenge. I do think APEC does now have this 3-decade-plus tradition of focusing on the economics. And I think that when you look back at that history, APEC has overcome the Asian financial crisis, 9/11, the global financial crisis, wars, and now, of course, the COVID pandemic. And we're still here as an organization, and we still have delegations from around the region who are fully participating and trying again to, you know, work towards some solutions. But yeah, it's challenging to keep some of the other stuff out. And one of the things I think is great about APEC, and I think I said it a moment ago, but is just that APEC can be a platform for bringing people together. So that, for example, last November, when there was a North Korean missile launch during the APEC Leaders Week, Vice President Harris and many of her counterparts from around the region who were concerned about that were able to get together and to be able to respond in kind because they were right there in Bangkok together. And so I think that's an important piece as well. I think there are times when, you know, people, including people in my own family, don't necessarily value the multilateral side of diplomacy. and ask a lot of questions. Well, why do we do this? Why do we engage in this way? But sometimes it's about being that platform for other conversations to take place as well. Because if we're not together, if we don't have an agenda that brings us together, then it's really hard when you need to always be picking up the phone long distance to try to solve difficult problems.
President Biden has said, and said multiple times, that China and the U.S. don't have to be enemies, even if they are rivals. How do you keep that intention on track?
Well, I can tell you that, for example, at my level, when I met with my Chinese counterpart the other day, every single thing we talked about was focused on the APEC agenda. It was focused on how are we advancing trade and investment in the region? How are we advancing innovation and digitalization in the region? How are we advancing sustainable, inclusive, and balanced growth in the region? My Chinese counterpart has some ideas. Some of them I agree with. Some of them I don't agree with. Then my team has some ideas. Some of those she agrees with and some of those she doesn't agree with. But the entire conversation was focused on the work at hand. And so I think that as we take these opportunities forward, as we head into some of the bigger meetings later in the year that we're hosting, ministerials in May and August and November, and then, of course, leaders in November, I think that this also, again, it gives us a reason to come together as a region, but also gives us a reason to come together and meet with and engage with some of our key partners and also just some of the key economies in our region like China. And so we wanted to fully take advantage of that opportunity.
If China decided to provide weapons to Russia to prosecute its war against Ukraine, if Xi Jinping more publicly and openly opened the cash window and became Russia's banker for 2023 and 24, would the other things that are in process, in train, between China and the United States be jeopardized? Would those decisions spill over into the other things that we're trying to cooperate on?
Well, I think, Ray, that, you know, as I talked to some of the former senior officials who have hosted APEC in recent times, you know, my counterparts from places like Thailand and New Zealand and Malaysia, they've all had or shared with me one piece of advice uniformly across all of them, which is you never know what's going to happen during your host year. You just can't predict. You know, there's events that happen around the world and we just don't know where things go. I mean, for our Malaysian counterparts, for example, they started the 2020 year. They had a great first senior officials meeting like we just had here in Palm Springs. They had one in Malaysia. And then it was just a few weeks later that COVID brought everything to a halt and they had to move meetings to all being virtual and online. Similarly, New Zealand, you know, the next year expected that we'd be coming out of the COVID pandemic by that point, but we weren't. So they had to have a whole year online. Last year, Thailand was excited that we were getting back to in-person meetings, but then it was during their first senior officials meeting that the Russia-Ukraine war started. And so I think the way I would just respond to that question is that you just never know what's going to happen. I don't want to make predictions on what ifs, but what we do know is that the world is a very dynamic and very complicated place, and you know, things can happen and we'll have to respond and pivot when they do.
As a senior American official, you have been very involved in China over the course of your career. I just don't want people who are listening to this program at home scratching their heads and thinking, why does he keep asking him about China? You just happen to know a lot about China. The country's economy has slowed down. But in recent years, it's been towing Asian prosperity along with it. It's a major Asian trading partner. Do questions about China's economic future inevitably cast a shadow over other economies in the region, like Vietnam's or Malaysia's?
Look, we all are asking questions about each of the economies in the region, and especially coming out of the COVID pandemic. You know, and as you said, I've spent a lot of my career living and working in China or working on China from the United States and spent a lot of my career thinking about some of the domestic economic challenges that they face. You know, in a lot of ways, they're looking at needing a transition to a more consumer-oriented economy that is really the goal of a lot of the economies around the Pacific Rim. And so in that way, it's not all that different. There's also obviously a lot of concerns about continuing to be able to attract investment, to be able to completely get out of the COVID situation. And I think one of the unifying things that we all talk about are supply chains and supply chain resiliency. And how can you make sure that all of us have what we need when we need it, when we're looking to go to the store and buy whatever it is at the price that we're hoping to get it for? That's really important to us in the United States. It's also important to people in China, and it's important to people around the region. So I think we're looking very closely at the domestic situation in all of our economies. But I think what we're also all realizing is that we need to continue to engage through organizations like APEC, because I know in the United States, we're not going to make, mine, and manufacture everything that we need in the United States. We're going to need to have strong partnerships. This region is responsible for half of all global trade. 60% of our exports go to the Asia-Pacific region. And we have in the United States about $1.5 trillion in investment from the Asia-Pacific region. So this is a group of economies that we just can't ignore in our engagement, even as we're all trying to strengthen our domestic economic situations.
There are 8 billion people in the world. 3 billion of them live in APEC members. How do you maximize America's advantage from these relationships?
I think that one of the things we've seen in our history is that the first sort of people to go focus westward were our businesses, were our private sector. Then there were cultural exchanges, and so the people-to-people ties. And so the United States government, in many ways, over the last 30, 40 years, has been following the example set by our private sector, by people-to-people ties, because that's where a lot of the engagement has been in the Asia-Pacific, and organizations like APEC have come out of that. So when you say, what is the U.S. kind of competitive advantage here, I think one of the big competitive advantages we have, and we're trying to really focus on this in our host year, is the way we can advance public-private collaboration, the way we can work with our business communities in a transparent way to really try to advance trade and investment in the region, the way we can work with other economies as well to try to promote sustainability through engagement with the private sector. And so I think that's a really important feature of what we want to make sure we focus on in our host year. And I think that there's still a lot of opportunities there in the region if we get that public-private piece right, and if our businesses have the right enabling environment across the region, and not just big businesses either, small and medium-sized enterprises, entrepreneurs, innovators, they all need the right enabling environment so that we can really move forward. And APEC is a place where through a consensus-based, non-binding way, we can be an incubator for some of the ideas that could really make a difference in that area.
The United States engaged in a lot of heavy lifting during the Obama years to come up with a final version or close to final version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And then there was a change in administration and Donald Trump pulled the United States out of the agreement and many of the remaining signatories moved ahead without the U.S. Did much come of that resulting agreement? Was it a loss to the United States not to be in it?
Well, I think what we're really focused on in the Biden administration right now is how can we, under the administration's Indo-Pacific strategy, really enhance our economic engagement with the region? And so I don't really want to comment on what might have been with the Trans-Pacific Partnership or comment on where it is now as now the CPTPP. But what we are trying to do through hosting APEC, through the launch of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, by working with the Quad, with Japan, Australia, and India on economic issues, by enhancing and lifting up some of our bilateral economic relationships, some of our key relationships like with Japan, I think is really important as we advance our economic engagement with the region. And so I think that's a real focus of the administration, and hosting APEC is a great way to give us the opportunity to do that in 2023.
One of the complicating factors in the American approach to free trade, from someone who's covered it for a long time, is that we open up our markets as part of a confidence-building agreement, as part of multilateral agreements, that we expect reciprocity on the other end. But in practice, consumers in other places in the world and ministries of trade, to be honest, in other places in the world, don't smooth the way for our goods. How do you fix that? Will the member states even cop to it? Will they admit that that's a thing that goes on?
Yeah, so I think that when we look at those kinds of situations, again, I think this is a real opportunity for APEC, because APEC does a lot with the 21 economies on trade facilitation, on addressing behind the border trade barriers, on looking at different goals that we do see when it comes to market access, and trying to assess those and come up with work plans to avoid those and overcome those around the region. It is a tremendous challenge. And I think in the 21st century, the other real challenge to this is it's not just about goods, but it's about services and it's about the digital economy. If you have economies in the region that have different approaches to cross-border data flows or to data privacy, that becomes a real hindrance to trade, especially in the services area where the U.S. has a competitive advantage. And so, you know, again, APEC is one of those places where we need to be here. We need to be in the trenches with these other economies in a leadership way, discussing these issues so that we can really work at making a better situation in the region. But at the end of the day, as a U.S. official, I'm very focused on how we can make this a better situation for our companies, which we want very much to lead to more jobs and to more economic prosperity at home.
Can you draw a straight line from these high-level international meetings, these tremendously packed gatherings that goes all the way from a factory in Texas or Pennsylvania or California to a supermarket in Jakarta or Singapore or Seoul? Can an American worker think, yeah, I understand why we're in APEC, because I can see the benefits of this kind of multilateral trade negotiation?
Well, it's always tough to draw a straight line, especially when you think about one of the things we learned during the COVID pandemic, that a global supply chain might involve the making of a product where the inputs for that product might, you know, cross borders 20, 30, 40 times as it goes through the manufacturing process. So it's always challenging to draw that straight line across the region. But what we want to do is to make sure that markets are as open as possible, that they're as transparent as possible, that U.S. exporters and importers have the opportunity to be able to trade with their counterparts, benefit from a trading system that works for everybody. And what we need to do, and a really important part of our APEC 2023 host year, is we really need to get out as well and talk to stakeholders and talk to local communities to get a better sense of how does this impact them when they think about their engagement with the region. I spent some time out here in the Palm Springs area, meeting with local businesses, meeting with indigenous-owned businesses, you know, talking to as many people as possible. We also had a couple of policy partnership discussions where the private sector was invited in so they could share both their concerns but also their best practices. And, you know, I think that's what I refer to as the secret sauce of APEC, this public-private collaboration, and the fact that we can get together and try to solve problems together. We hope through that we can be a positive answer for somebody at home in Texas, in Illinois, in Missouri, in Idaho, who has a product, who's trying to get it to market. And especially for APEC is a great organization for looking out for small and medium-sized enterprises and also trying to make sure we connect the dots. So it's always tough to draw a straight line, but we're trying. There'll be some fits and starts in certain sectors, and we all need to make sure that we continue to all work in the same direction, but I'm very optimistic that we're moving in the right direction.
Matt Murray is a career Foreign Service officer. He's just marking 1 year as the U.S. senior official for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. Good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ray. Great to be here.
You've been listening to On Shifting Ground, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from listeners like you. And for transparency on this episode, World Affairs partnered with APEC to bring you the perspectives from officials on the ground there. Today's episode was produced by Elise Manoukian, Matteo Schimpf, and Andrew Stelzer. It was mixed and mastered by Matteo Schimpf.
Additional production and engineering were provided by Rob Spate. KQED's Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Jared Sport is our executive producer. Philip Young is CEO of World Affairs. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.